This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. When he was a teenager, Eric Newsom was haunted by the image of a young girl in a blue dress. He would dream about her and believe she lived in his parents' attic. Newsom's memoir, Giving Up the Ghost, is about how this disturbing vision defined his adolescence and how he came to confront his fears and memories. He writes that he was a, quote, tsunami of dork as a weird and lonely teenager with long hair, piercings, a Kiss tribute band, and a fondness for drugs. His book is subtitled A Story About Friendship, 80s Rock, A Lost Scrap of Paper, and What It Means to be Haunted. Eric Newsom is the vice president for programming at NPR, and he joins us from the studios at NPR in Washington, D.C. And Eric, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Was this book a kind of exorcism for you?
It was, in a sense. You know, when it started off, I really had no intention. If you had told me a number of years ago that I would be sitting here discussing the stories in this book to you, I would think you were crazy, because this has been a history of mine that I really have never talked about with anybody. And it started off writing a book about why I'm scared of ghosts, or confronting my fear of ghosts. And as I started writing it, it became clear to me that that wasn't the book that I wanted to write. I wanted to write why I was scared of ghosts instead of just that I was scared of ghosts.
The last time we had you on the show, we were talking about a previous book about vampires. Do you think there's a connection between you, vampires, and ghosts?
No, outside of just the fact that there is one passing reference in that book about vampires that I'm scared of ghosts. And people who read the book kept bringing it up. They thought it was funny that somebody who was writing about vampires was scared of, actually more scared of ghosts than any other kind of supernatural thing. And so I thought, okay, I'll just kind of roll with that. Maybe that's something I would like to explore, and had no intention of ever writing a memoir.
This book is about this ghost that haunted you, to use your own language, this young girl in a blue dress. Describe what she looked like to our listeners.
Well, I would always see her at the end of a trail, like in a forest, like a path. And I could see her. She was probably 9 or 10 years old, blonde hair past her shoulders, a blue dress, and she would be staring as if she was staring right through me. And as I walk towards her in these dreams, she starts speaking to me in gibberish, and I start to notice things like she's wet, like her skin and her hair are wet, but I don't remember her dress being wet. And as I got closer, she would just start talking in gibberish faster and louder, and almost like more desperate to try to have me understand what she was saying. And then I'd wake up.
A recurrent dream that you had.
Yeah, I had it. I had variations on it. Sometimes, like, a real common variation was I was blindfolded and I knew what was happening, but I just couldn't see it. And I could hear it and I could feel myself walking along the path. And other times I would just have like a little snapshot of it. And sometimes it would happen every night. And sometimes I would go months in between having it. And it just became this presence in my life that when it happened, it kind of became an obsession. And then I very happily just denied it, forgot about it when it wasn't happening.
You even went so far as to believe that this ghost, this little girl, was living in your parents' attic.
Yeah, for no real solid reason outside of I would have these dreams. And at the end of the dream, I would wake up, oftentimes sitting up in my bed. And I would look around the room, and I just had this disoriented feeling. And I'm like, is that girl here? And then, you know, we lived in an old house in Canton, Ohio. It creaked and made noises and all sorts of stuff. And I just, in my head, put together those noises are the girl that I would see in my dream, and I would wake up and think was there, and just kind of wrapped all this in a package that sounds crazy, but to me at the time made complete sense that that's what all this was.
Well, I'd love to have you read a section from your book, a chapter that's titled Then.
Yeah. Eric, my dad shouted downstairs. Phone. It was about 7 or 8 at night in June, a year before things got really bad. My room was in the attic of our house on 34th Street in Canton, Ohio. The closest phone was in the den a floor below. I'd spent the evening before raiding my pill stash and washing it down with a warm 12-pack of Wiedemann, drooling for a while and then throwing the bottles over the neighbor's roof. I hadn't left my room at all that day, mostly because I couldn't work up the courage. Leaving meant walking by the door to the spare room. My family rarely went in there, except to get Christmas decorations, wrapping paper, or whatever else was stored in its closets and crawl spaces. The door was always closed. It was always dark in there and terribly hot in summer. Of course, my room was the same way, just on the opposite side of the hall. But it wasn't the heat or dinginess I minded. The spare room was where she was. Usually, when I could tell she was there, I'd summon the strength to run by the door before she could realize I was just an arm's length away. This morning, I wondered if she could simply reach out and grab me as I ran by. I never thought of that before. Therefore, I just sat there, too scared to find out the answer to my new question. Earlier that day, I thought I'd heard her moving around on the other side of the door. I'd slowly walked out of my room into the hallway, barely breathing so that I could hear any other telltale noise. I told myself that I was going to walk right up to the door, call her out, swing the door open suddenly, and have this over with. But of course I never did. Instead, I used the phone call as an excuse to run past the door and down the stairs. Nothing reached out and grabbed me. Despite the fact that my fear had kept me captive for more than 12 hours, urinating in an empty soda bottle to avoid having to go downstairs to the bathroom, as I rounded the landing to head downstairs, I had already forgotten all about it.
And again, that's Eric Newsom reading from his memoir, a new book called Giving Up the Ghost. And it's, you know, that's such a scary passage to be, I'm not sure how old you are at this, but to truly believe that there was this ghost, this girl that was hiding in a room in your house.
Yeah, on the other side of the door. And I was 17 or 18 at the time. And it was such a common experience in my teenage years that it, like, when you talk about that being scary, yeah, to me, that was just a description of a day. And it wasn't even intended to be scary. It was just kind of to illustrate my state of mind in that I lived my life by avoiding that door. Whenever I heard her, which was any noise in an old house, I interpreted it as her, or that I had one of these dreams. And would just sit there and stare at that door thinking, okay, I'm just going to... And actually did this many, many times. I would walk up to the door, kind of rush up to it, swing it, and just swing the door open as quickly as I could, figuring if there was something there that before it could dematerialize or escape, I would see it. And I did this over and over and over and over again, thinking I would catch her.
I mean, it's... It sounds like a hallucination. I mean, and you write in your book how you would close your eyes really tight and open them, thinking that if she's there, I will see her. You never see her, obviously.
Yeah, you know, in all truth, I still do that to this day.
Do you really?
When I'm in a situation where I'm worried that I am going to see a ghost, I say, okay, I'm going to close my eyes. I say this out loud. I'm going to close my eyes. And if there's a ghost here, you're going to be here when I open my eyes. That's as if I have the power to make that demand. And if there's not, then I'm cool. And I would shut my eyes and open them. And I've never seen anything, but I tell you, every time I shut my eyes to do that exercise, I'm prepared that I'm going to open my eyes and something's going to be right there in front of me.
It sounds like you're trying to be very rational about having a ghost.
Yeah, which is like the most irrational thing in the world. But right,
exactly.
Yeah.
But you think you're also looking for her?
Her? You know, at the time, yeah. One of the interesting things pretty much in the course of the book I wrote, is the time period in which I had those dreams. I've never had one, probably in more than 20 years. Mm. But it doesn't mean I'm not scared of ghosts. I mean, just the other day, someone was kind of jokingly sending me a report. A local burger chain is opening a new restaurant in our area, and some of the workmen there thought they saw a ghost while they were renovating this burger place. And they thought that was a funny thing, and they sent it to me. And this is like, you know, 2 days ago. And when I read that story, I couldn't turn around when I was sitting at my desk because I was scared. I was sitting in my basement in a dark office, and I'm like, I'm going to turn around. Something's going to be there.
Mm. You better get used to this since you've written a book called Giving Up the Ghost. But, you know, as I was reading your book, and you're talking about a literal ghost, I mean, a metaphoric ghost as well, but I was thinking about my own metaphoric ghost from, you know, from my adolescence or from my childhood or recent past. I mean, it seems that we're all haunted by some ghost in one way or the other.
It makes almost the real ghosts, you know, moot or inconsequential. Mm-hmm. When you look at, in reality, we all have ghosts that linger in our lives. And I think I realized through the course of writing this book, you know, my original intention, the book I was originally going to write was I was going to go to a bunch of haunted places to see what happened firsthand and prove to no one else but myself whether or not this was real, this whole concept of there being ghosts. And by the time I finished the book, I realized that was such a silly question. And it didn't even matter that people are haunted, not places.
Well, and I have to say your descriptions of your own adolescence, and I think troubled is probably not too strong a word, but I think we all struggled through our adolescence in one way or another. But you describe the tsunami of dork. If we were to see you in Canton, Ohio, you know, 15, 16, 17 years old, what would we have seen?
Well, the weird thing is you probably would have seen what appeared on the outside as a happy-go-lucky tsunami of dork, because that really is kind of what I tried to project myself as being, and not very successfully. I was, you know, I wore glasses, you know, had crooked teeth, wasn't very good at athletics, didn't have a lot of friends, wasn't very involved in things, was never the first person really people thought of for anything, and was just kind of there and never really kind of fit in, never really had a click. You know, I had friends, but I never really kind of felt connected to anything. And you know, many people have to deal with all that. I just kind of, the reason I say tsunami of dork is I had it kind of
all at once.
Yeah, yeah.
You also had, we're about a minute before our first break here, but you also had these things that were referred to as Eric-isms. What's an example of that?
I still do.
Oh, you still do. Okay, yeah, so what's an Eric-ism?
You won't find a blue pen anywhere in my life.
Oh, no blue pens.
I will never eat another crab cake. I will... I always touch the outside of an airplane before I go in it. These are not obsessions. These are actually things that started off as being fairly normal to me and just kind of feel like just like swallowing, just natural things. Mm-hmm. And my friends find no end of delight in identifying these and then quizzing me about their origins.
Just to drive you crazy, right?
Yeah, no, not really drive me crazy, but they think it's just so odd.
Well, and I guess zucchini's on that list as well, right?
Yeah, the whole reason that was is my parents planted six zucchini plants one summer and ended up with making every kind of food you can imagine with zucchini. And I said, I'm never going to eat any more zucchini because my mother actually delighted in hiding zucchini in things. So I'm never eating it again. I made this pronouncement, this declaration, and I never have.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Eric Newsom. He is the vice president for programming for NPR, and he's also the author of a new book, a memoir called Giving Up the Ghost, a story about friendship, 80s rock, a lost scrap of paper, and what it means to be haunted. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. Independence Blue Cross is dedicated to transforming healthcare to make a better coordinated system that is built around you. They're committed to leading the way to focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it, pioneering new ways to pay healthcare professionals based on the quality of care, and using technology to update your medical information electronically so everyone can be informed. Further details online at ibx.com. Independence Blue Cross, changing the game.
Adult classes are forming now for the WHYY Hamilton Commons. Learn about shooting and editing digital video, as well as crafting your own documentary. Classes begin on September 12th with Intro to Shooting Video. On September 19th, enter the world of editing digital video. And in October, a four-week class will help you craft your own documentary. For more information and a full course listing, visit whyy.org/Hamilton Commons.
Imagine being offered a large sum of money to leave the home and neighbors you've always known. potential windfall for you could be enormous, and you have to decide what to do, whether to take the offer or not to.
It's the decision faced by the residents of a fictional apartment building in Mumbai. Award-winning author Aravinda Diga talks about his latest book, Last Man in Tower, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, Eric Newsom is our guest. We're talking about his new book, a memoir called Giving Up the Ghost. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Eric, in your subtitle, a story about a friendship. And this friendship is one that you had with a high school classmate, a girl named Laura. Describe Laura to our listeners.
Well, Laura was incredibly bright and very funny, and someone I really never thought of as being a potential close friend. She was just this bright little preppy thing, and she went away on an exchange trip to Finland, and I think she used that, she was a junior in high school, I think, and she used that time to kind of figure out who she was, you know, because she was in a very different, odd place. And she kind of came back transformed. She was kind of like this. I often say it's like someone put her in a vat of punk rock and brined her in it for a while. And she came back. You know, she cut her own hair, which was a bunch of different colors. She'd altered all her clothing. She had discovered all this great music and this great literature, and was just the most interesting, fascinating person in the world to me. And, you know, she carried around a lot of her own ghosts and demons. But she kind of became the person I wanted to impress, and who I wanted to always be pleased with me.
Well, it's interesting because she was a girl who was a friend, but not a girlfriend.
Yeah, she was the kind of person who just had no interest in being tied down to anything or anyone. And the more you kind of tried to, even kind of subvertly to do so, she would push back. And she had many trappings of being a girlfriend, yet also refused any kind of connection in that way. And then that would also often change, like, day by day, week by week. And I was at the time so enamored by her that whatever works.
And you said that you wanted to impress her. How did you do that?
Well, you know, I had this kind of like quasi-fictional rock and roll band that I was putting together with my friend Jimmy, and I made, tried to impress her with all the cool things we planned to do, and we exchanged tapes a lot and of music that we both had discovered and found, and really ended up loving what we exposed each other to, and it really was a mutual relationship of, I think she was curious about me and the way I looked at the world and how I saw the world. And I was just, she was so worldly to me that being around her exposed me to ideas and things that I had never thought were possible. And being kids in Canton, Ohio, who were lucky to have a driver's license and access to a car and nothing else, we would just spend our nights, you know, if we had $4, we would put $4 in the tank and we would just drive, kind of like this rolling living room. And we had a number of about, you know, 8 or 10 places around the Canton area where we would hide. We could put the car and hang out that were fun, comfortable places for us to be, that no one would bother us or we weren't bothering anyone. And that was where we really lived our relationship.
Well, you include on your website a playlist of music, and I do want to play two songs that are included there, and they're also part of your story. This was a song that she gave you, Fire Dances, from this British punk band called Killing Joke. Do you want to just say, I guess, what was she telling you by giving you this music?
There was a whole narrative about self-discovery and discovering Killing Joke for her. Even though she was an exchange student in Finland, she took her very meager amount of money she had available to her and went around to tour rock festivals and to see bands. Killing Joke was one of her favorite discoveries. And if a listener has never heard them before, when they hear the song, they will have the same experience I did when I first heard it for the first time. Even though this song is probably 25 years old, at the time, there was nothing like it in the world. And it just showed that there were many more colors in the universe than I knew, just within the first 10 seconds of hearing the piece of music.
Well, we're going to play about 60 seconds of this piece of music. Let's listen. Again, a song called Fire Dances from the British punk band Killing Joke, and it's a title track from a 1983, I guess, album they probably had back in those days.
Yeah.
Eric, does that bring back memories?
Oh, it does, obviously, to hear it. It's very exciting to for me to have be associated with that in any way, obviously. You know, it's funny because a lot of things in this book are so weird to look back at. Mm. You know, that was from 1983, you know, almost 30 years ago. If you talked to Kurt Cobain, he would have listed Killing Joke as one of his primary influences. If you talked to Metallica, they would have said Killing Joke was one of their primary influences. And most people who hear it today are hearing it post those influences. And so it doesn't sound nearly as revolutionary, I'm sure, to people today as it did then.
Well, you gave her, you gave Laura, is it 2/1 from Brian Eno's ambient album Music for Airports?
Brian Eno fans debate whether it's 2/1, 2.1, or if it has any title at all. It was just a numerical indicator of where mm-hmm. the track was. This is on the second side of the album, the first song, so therefore 2/1.
And why did you give this to Laura?
I bought music. I was first exposed to Music for Airports when I was a preteen, and fell in love with it because it literally is unlike most things anyone has ever heard. It's just a collection of fairly random notes, kind of that are triggered and played kind of in random odd sequences, yet come together in quite striking and beautiful ways.
2/1. Go ahead.
Oh, it was probably the original what people call to as ambient music. Is probably the original album that. Was this, and I have gone through probably a dozen different copies of this album in my life, because whenever I find someone who I think might like it, I just give them my copy.
Oh, wow. Well, let's listen. This is 2/1 from Brian Eno's album Music for Airports. Short selection there. So, Eric, did Laura like the music? What was her response to that?
Oh, she loved it. As much as I loved and now fawn over Killing Joke. I mean, the truth was that we were also, while we were very impressed by each other and wanted to impress each other, we often tried to be very cool with each other too. That I had never admitted to her that I loved Killing Joke. Yet then she would also end up eventually over the next couple of weeks finding every album they had ever released in my little cassette holder. So, but I never would admit, oh no, you turned me on to this. No, that we would never have done that.
And that's Eric Newsom, our guest today on Radio Times. He's actually a vice president for programming for NPR and the author of a new book, a memoir called Giving Up the Ghost. And I'll do the subtitle again, A Story About a Friendship. That was the friendship that he had with his friend Laura. 80s rock. He did have a Kiss tribute band. We'll talk about that. A Lost Scrap of Paper and What It Means to Be Haunted. And again, any questions or comments, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You also told Laura, your friend, about this ghost. You shared with her, maybe unusually shared with her, this apparition that you lived with.
And I told her about this little girl in a blue dress who I saw in my dreams and was convinced was in the attic. And she treated it like it was a metaphor and wanted to discuss it as a metaphor. And I would say, no. I'm being serious. I think this happens to me. And I don't know what it means, and it's kind of, but it feels really bad. And she would want to explore what I thought it represented, what was going on in my life that was kind of thematically connected, almost like I was telling her about a piece of literature or something. Mm. And we were discussing it the way that, you know, high school kids who think they're really brainy talk about literature. And it frustrated me because I never really was able to tell her in a way I felt she heard that I'm in trouble. And I have these visions, and I think this is a harbinger of doom, and I don't know what to do. And I don't know if I ever told her that clearly, but I thought at the time I was. And she would just say, basically, wow, that's really fascinating. Hmm. And even though I give her credit as probably the person who kind of saved me from myself during this time, in a way, it frustrated me at the time, but I could see in hindsight that she kind of was also being kind of an anchor point and not getting too wrapped up in it. And perhaps without meaning to, she was kind of offering me another way to look at it.
You did end up being hospitalized. I guess it was a mental institution.
It was a mental ward in a hospital, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was unclear to me whether you certainly were thinking about suicide.
Yeah, you know, I was interesting. I've talked to a couple people about this. People think that I was, in essence, killing myself or attempting to kill myself, even though I wasn't doing anything that clean and direct, that my behavior was meant to kind of remove options and remove different pathways to me so that there would only be one pathway left, which would be to end my life. I was quite... I would think it's debatable whether or not I had a suicide attempt, but I was definitely suicidal. I mean, I carried around a vial of sleeping pills in my pocket for months.
You're right. 18-year-olds were supposed to have bright futures. They weren't supposed to be broken. They weren't supposed to be haunted by dead girls. They weren't supposed to feel so much anger and pain with no reason why. And I think for anybody who's you know, dealing with the sort of angst that you were dealing with, especially as an adolescent, that's really painful to read.
Yeah, and I don't think I really realized that when I wrote it. When you write things, it's a years long process between when you write something and when someone reads it.
Yeah.
And when people talk about, wow, this was really kind of hard to read, even though there are parts of it that are funny and engaging, parts are really hard to read. That always strikes me as odd, because that's just really. It's not meant to be dramatized or glorified or hyperbolized in any way. It really is just kind of, that's the way I looked at the world.
And were you helped by being hospitalized?
Probably every time I think about it, I give a different answer.
What's your answer today?
I think my answer today is, yeah, it helped me. I would never have admitted it at the time. I think that... 1980s mental health care was kind of barbaric by today's standards. It basically focused around just inebriating you to the point of being so zombified that you could sit in group therapy sessions and they would just slowly then lighten up your medication and hope that at some point you'd click in and participate in the process. And so even though I was a fairly frequent drug and alcohol user when I went into the hospital, I was more inebriated when I was there than I ever was before I went in, and found that incredibly difficult, was very resistant, was combative, did things that were meant to get myself in trouble, had no other explanation to them, and eventually had so much freedom taken away from me and was under so much restrictions that one evening I just decided I don't want to live a life where I have to eat with a spork and have someone watch me when I shave.
And a spork is a fork and a spoon put together, right?
Yeah, yeah, which is, you know, of course they don't going to give mental patients knives and forks, so they give you these little things that are meant to keep you from doing harm to yourself.
You include your diagnosis in here. I'm looking at it right now. Atypical depression schizotypal personality disorder. That's what that's how they described you.
Yeah, someone who slowly disassociates himself from others in society and has quasi-paranoid delusions about why he is isolated from the world. And that's often a gateway to schizophrenia.
As you said, and you write about, you were doing a lot of drugs and alcohol at this time in your life.
Yeah.
Do you think that fed your depression, your anger, all that you were going through?
Yeah. Well, it definitely created situations in which they weren't getting any better. Among people who knew me at the time and are aware of the history I had and are aware of the very few people who I had ever told about little girl and the dreams that I had, to a person, they feel that this was all chemically induced. They're like, you know, you were just out of your mind about this. And the two correlated. And they point to the fact that when I kind of cleaned myself up, they slowed down to almost stopping as evidence of this. So, but I to this day couldn't tell you what was real and not real. And I think that if drugs and alcohol did anything to me, you know, I did them not because I wanted to be high, but because I just wanted to be in pause or just stop for a minute, you know, just like, I just don't want to feel anything right now. I think that what the effect of all that was I kind of lost touch with what was real and what wasn't real. How I looked at the world, the whole little girl thing, you know, the motivations of people around me, which I often felt was against me. I think the drugs and alcohol, the only thing they did was really accelerate that process. Mm.
You did have a psychiatrist. You had many people that you spoke to in this hospital. You had a psychiatrist that you talked to. Was that helpful in any way, in hindsight?
At first, it was horrible. That almost every session with him would end up with me being removed from his office because I would just scream at him because I thought he was an idiot. And he controlled everything to me. The psychiatrist and psychologist, or between the two of them, they basically ran my life when I was in the hospital. And so I looked at them as being the enemy, not the helper. And when I had that revelation of I didn't want to live this way anymore, the next morning I walked into his office, the therapist's office, and I said, I don't care what it is, I will do it as long as the pathway is I'm out of here. I will take any test, I will sit in any therapy session, I will answer any question, I will discuss any topic, as long as it is focused on getting me out of here. And that's basically how I survived.
Right. I mean, that sounds like a breakthrough in many ways.
Yeah, you know, and I would never, ever, ever have admitted that. And I'm even hesitant to do so to this day.
Oh, interesting.
Because I think that I just needed to be of such a strong wake-up call. But the change in the motivation had to be in me, whether I wanted it to be or not.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Eric Newsom today on Radio Times. He's vice president for programming for NPR, author of a new book, a memoir called Giving Up the Ghost. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Announcing the 2012 WHYY Connections Festival, September 6th through 9th. 4 days of free arts and culture events, including an outdoor concert featuring Yola Tango, Frank Turner, Maps and Atlases, and more, Saturday, September 8th. And on September 9th, performances by Fred Parris and the Five Satins, Charlie Gracie, and more at the Philadelphia Doo-Wop Festival. More artists and events to come. Visit whyy.org/connectionsfestival.
Voter ID laws have cropped up in many states as the 2012 election approaches. Do they suppress votes or prevent fraud? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Nate Persily, a professor of law and political science at Columbia University, and with State Representative Daryl Metcalf, who sponsored Pennsylvania's voter ID law. It went into effect this year, but is under legal challenge. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What is Paul Ryan's blueprint for the federal budget? We know he'd cut spending on Medicaid and Pell Grants, but he'd increase spending on defense. Also, typos and texting. We'll check out the website Damn You Autocorrect. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Eric Newsom. As an adolescent, he believed that he was being haunted by a ghost, a vision of a young girl in a blue dress. He thought about suicide. He ended up being hospitalized. And one person he could depend on in this tough time in his life was a high school classmate named Laura. He writes about all of this in his frank, and it is funny, I should say, frank and funny memoir called Giving Up the Ghost. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Laura from Washington, D.C. to join us. And Laura, go ahead. You're on the air.
I'm just wondering if Eric has stayed in touch with Laura or knows what happened with Laura.
It's a good question. You want to take that, Eric?
What an odd segue at this
yes,
point
indeed.
In our conversation.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Laura, in D.C., to tell you. Actually, the last part of the book is detailing out what happened after I left the hospital. Which was, in short, Laura stuck around for several months and was pretty much the only person who still hung around with me and had been very cagey about what her plans were for college. And around this time, late August, she said, I'm leaving in a couple weeks to go to New York City to go to school. And that's it. Sorry I didn't tell you, but that's what my plan is. And I became very angry that she had not told me this. Very angry. I felt in a very narcissistic way. I felt that she was betraying me or leaving me when I felt I needed her most. And the last couple weeks we had together were very kind of tension filled. She left, and it kind of, you know, occasional letters or postcards went back and forth. But I was such a jerk to her about leaving that I'm surprised she ever spoke to me again. She and it caused a lot of tension between us. We would talk occasionally. We would talk about getting together, but rarely did we see each other, maybe on a handful of occasions did we spend time together, and never like we did before. Then a couple years later, she actually, her time in New York was not very good to her. She ended up dropping out of school and moving back to Canton and taking a waitressing job and never told me that this was happening. And I think the reason why is I made such a point about New York is going to destroy you. It's going to eat you up. You can't afford to do things. It's so far different from what you know. I had made such a big deal out of this that when that, in essence, came true, she would never have wanted to admit that to me. One night I was walking, had a version of the little girl dream, or a part of it. And deciding to go for a walk. And as I'm walking down the street in downtown Kent, Ohio, where I went to school, a mutual friend of ours was also walking down the street, who didn't even live in that city, was visiting friends. And they were out going around the bars. We exchanged phone numbers. I talked to her the next night, and she said, well, how are you feeling about this Laura business? And I said, what are you talking about? And she realized that I didn't know what she was talking about and then wanted to end the phone call immediately. And I said, no, you have to tell me. And she said, Eric, Laura was killed. And I was obviously in shock and went to the people in my life that had known both of us, most of which I hadn't talked to since I kind of fell apart. So here I am coming back into their lives years later, devastated by this news. And it was several weeks had transpired since she had died and till this conversation had happened. So I was in a completely different stage of grief than they were. And they just kind of just didn't want to deal with me. But so they told me the basics, which was that Laura had been riding her bike down the street going to the drugstore. And when she had left the drugstore, she left the parking lot, went out into the street, into a through traffic lane, and was hit by a car and killed instantly.
Oh, gosh.
And it was it was another turning point in my life where I realized that at that point I could have just said, you know what, I who cares? You know, let's just forget this folly of trying to make things work. It's very romantic to think that I got my life together when I was in the hospital and went on to do great things. But, you know, the truth is, as in many cases, it was not a clear, smooth path. And I'd had some rough starts and points and take many steps backwards. And I looked at this as being my ultimate excuse to go right back to where I was. And I decided not to.
Yeah.
And it's a decision, you know, Laura saved me from one ghost and became another.
Do you miss her?
Yeah. Lately, now that this book is out, yeah, it's kind of rekindled her in a very real way for not just me, but other people in her life. And I realized that by my action of writing this book, I've really stirred her up for a lot of other people. I think it's ultimately a good thing, but when I look at the ghosts in my life, I don't really worry about the little girl or whether some floating head's going to come down a hallway as much now as I realize that when, you know, something I've never told anyone before and till now is that when I started writing this book, I started to have dreams where I saw Laura again.
Really?
And in the dream, she was begging me not to do it.
To do what?
Write the book.
Oh, to write the book. Oh, my goodness.
And it was at that time I realized that I wasn't seeing the spirit of my friend. I was seeing my fear of going back into that time of my life, and my fear put on a mask of her to, because it thought it would work.
So she's become a metaphor as opposed to this real-life ghost that had haunted you as a kid. And that touches on so many things about going home, trying to rekindle relationships with, you know, adolescent friends and whether
I hadn't spoken to her family since she died.
Yeah.
And became reacquainted with her mother again and became acquainted with her brother, who last time I saw him, he was like 10.
Hmm.
And was also struggling at the time to understand his sister, who he didn't really know very well.
Yeah. Sounds like no one really knew her very well, the way you write.
You felt intensely close to her, but you realized that you didn't know her.
Let me segue into another part of your adolescence, only because not everyone can say this, but I guess you had a Kiss tribute band. Would that be fair enough?
Well, you could call it that. I think it would technically be described as a Kiss tribute band. You know, music has always been something I loved. I think music has always been kind of like my primary social calling card to the world about what I am and who I feel or how I feel. And a couple friends of mine and I, when we were preteens, were huge fans of Kiss. We would listen to albums and talk about them all the time and collect clippings and the rest of the world just didn't get how awesome this band was. And they were to us it. And so we decided we would form a Kiss tribute band, which we called Kiss Junior. And it was complicated by my friend Terry had gotten a guitar but didn't know how to play it yet. His sister was involved and I was involved. I had a little electric organ that I could move back and forth. And since there's not many Kiss songs that call for unplayable guitar, tambourine, and electric organ, what we would do is we would have this massive, huge hi-fi and we would put on Kiss records as loud as we could make them. And we would just bang along with them and sing, and that was our tribute band.
And who would come to these concerts that you would give?
Well, unfortunately, Kiss Jr. only had one concert, which was after a birthday party. We invited a bunch of kids down in the basement, and we had a bunch of they had it all set up with a little bed sheet with a KISS logo with Junior written underneath it behind us. And we started playing, and after about half of one song, people just kind of, who had been kind of confused looks from these other preteens, they just kind of walked out of the basement and went back upstairs to the party and just kind of left us there. And but still, it was I remember that moment of playing, and it was one of the most thrilling experiences of my life. That's, I'm not being corny by saying that. It really was. I loved every second of that day.
I have to say that Patty McMahon, the producer, just typed in costumes, makeup, cod pieces, Gene Simmons.
Oh, yeah, we had actually, we had a rather unfortunate incident with KISS Jr. The thing that ended it was one day when Terry's parents were going to see a movie, we bought some like Halloween makeup from the cheap grease makeup that from a 5 and 10 and tried to do our own KISS-inspired designs on our faces while they weren't home. And they came home while we were doing it. So we ran a bath, jumped in, tried to clean up our faces. His parents came in and were like, what are you guys doing? Like, oh, we're taking a bath. And then when we got done, we came downstairs, and the parents were really just not buying the story that we were taking a bath.
I wonder
while
why.
They were gone. Yeah. And then his stepfather looked at my eyes and said, what's that around your eyes? And I said, makeup. Then he started screaming like these accusations of, are you kids gay? And we're like, hey, man, this is rock and roll. You just got to deal with it.
We're KISS Junior, right?
Yeah, we're KISS Junior, man. You just got adults just don't get it. And so that was we got grounded for this whole escapade of being mouthy and doing this supposedly terrible activity of putting makeup on our faces. While no one was home. And I think that was the end of KISS Jr.
You know, I just have to ask you, only because every now and then I bump into Gene Simmons' reality show on TV, Family Jewels. You watch him being basically bossed around by his children and now his wife.
Yeah.
Do you watch that? Have you seen it?
No.
Do you want to?
Oddly, Gene Simmons is a very interesting character. I don't really like him. You know, it's one of these things of, yeah, I don't really like him. I guess that's the bottom line. It's one of these things that when someone is mysterious to you, they're much more interesting and alluring. And when you discover who they are, they lose the allure and you're left with a human. And that's sometimes you like learning about that human. And sometimes you'd rather they just stayed mysterious. And I think that KISS is a perfect example of that, of when you never saw what they really looked like, when you never saw what their lives were like. You romanticized what they were, and they became heroes to you. And when he became human and has kids who talk back to him, and he's obviously an aging man and isn't still 27 years old, he becomes human, and you don't want him to be.
Yeah. Are you surprised that you're vice president for programming for NPR?
Why would I be surprised?
Well, I don't know. We've been spending, you know, almost an hour talking about your troubled childhood, your troubled adolescence.
No, I'm not surprised at all, because that's actually what happened. What surprises me much more is that I'm sitting, you know, if you had told Laura and I when we were driving around the streets of Canton, Ohio, that someday I would be sitting in Washington, D.C. talking to an interviewer in Philadelphia, and that tens or hundreds of thousands of people were going to hear this conversation talking about those nights driving around Canton, Ohio.
Yeah.
I don't think we could have been able to in any way understand that. To me, that's much more crazy than that I'm the vice president of programming at NPR.
Well, and I think it's a wonderful reminder, especially for those of us that had troubled childhoods, to know that sometimes that trouble ends and there's a happy ending. Doesn't often feel that way in adolescence.
I've always been someone who had to have their head beaten pretty hard to get a message, as evidenced in many ways in my life. And sometimes there's a cliche that pain clears out room for more joy.
Yeah.
And even though that is a cliche, I think there's a kernel of truth to it, that there are two people in the world who experience pain, those who allow themselves to kind of be framed by it, and those who use it as an example of what they don't want to be.
What does Canton, Ohio look like today? And I ask because the prologue to the book is this, I have to say, wonderful description of you and a friend, Jimmy, and Laura actually playing miniature golf at a closed-down golf course in Canton, Ohio, and it sounded like it was a place on its last legs.
Yeah, you know, people have been writing the obituary of Northeast Ohio and life in Ohio for my entire life. Not only is Canton an industrial town who is experiencing globalization, nearby Akron, Ohio, where my family is actually from, we used to be the center of the rubber industry and the tire industry. And we've seen it being kicked down and kicked and kicked and kicked. It's the same type of thing. You know, the more you kick, the stronger you make me. And I have a rule in my life that no one's ever allowed to make fun of Ohio unless you've actually lived there. Because then you understand it. And, you know, there's something to be said for rising above the expectations and knocks you're handed in life. And I think that Canton, Ohio lives that every day.
We're almost out of time here. Do you still have family there? Any?
My parents live near there. They don't live in Canton anymore. No, I it's odd because the last time I was there was when my grandmother died about a year ago. And in order to get from the hotel I was staying with my parents, actually. When I drove into town, I had to drive by the intersection that Laura died.
Oh, wow.
And that was going back and forth to say goodbye and then and to go to her funeral. And every time it was like, I remember driving through the intersection and my wife saying, "This is where this happened, isn't it?"
Mm-hmm.
Just from reading the book, she recognized where it was. I said, yeah.
Well, Eric, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And Eric Newsom, our guest, I should spell his last name, N-U-Z-U-M. His memoir is called Giving Up the Ghost, a story about friendship, 80s rock, a lost scrap of paper, and what it means to be haunted. And again, Vice President for Programming at NPR. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about this program. And we do want to close things out with a song from Kiss, God of Thunder, from a 1976 album.